A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headache.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about object storage as the real foundation underneath everything we call cloud storage. What actually is a blob? What is an object? How big can these things get if you're planning a migration? And then the part I find genuinely interesting. When we organize files into folders, how is that hierarchy actually recorded? Because it turns out it's nothing like what's happening on your laptop. And finally, interoperability. If you've got a blob store and you want to sync it with Google Drive, or sync Google Drive with Google Cloud Storage, without handing your data to some questionable third-party tool, R. Sloan is the go-to. He wants to know how it actually works under the hood.
Oh, this is a good one. And by the way, quick note, today's episode script is being generated by DeepSeek V4 Pro, which I appreciate because this topic has layers.
It really does. And I think the place to start is just defining what a blob actually is, because people throw that word around, and it's one of those terms where everyone nods and half the room is bluffing.
So BLOB stands for Binary Large Object. The term was popularized by Microsoft with Azure Blob Storage, but the concept is universal across all object storage. An object, or a blob, has exactly three components. The data itself, the raw binary content. A unique identifier, which is basically a key or an address, and metadata, which is descriptive information like the file name, the content type, the size, when it was created. That's it.
The key distinction, the thing that separates this from the file systems we grew up with, is how you access it.
Object storage is accessed through H. You're not mounting it as a drive, you're not using S. You send a request, you get an object back. It's designed for unstructured data. Images, videos, documents, backups, log files, entire virtual machine images. The whole point is that you don't need a file system hierarchy to find things, you just need the key.
This is where the folder question gets really interesting, because when you look at an object storage bucket, it sure looks like it has folders. You see paths, you see slashes, you see nested directories, but that's a lie.
It's a complete fiction. And I love this because it's one of those things where the user interface is so convincing that most people never question it. Object storage uses what's called a flat namespace. Every single object exists at the same logical level. There are no real directories, no real folders. What looks like a folder path, say photo/2025/vacation.jpgz, that entire string is just the object's key. The slashes are just characters in the key. They have no special meaning to the storage system.
When the A shows you a folder called Photos, what's actually happening?
When you list objects and you specify a delimiter, typically the forward slash, the A scans all the keys, groups them by the common prefix before that delimiter, and returns those prefixes as what it calls common prefixes. It's generating the illusion of folders on the fly. There's no directory entry stored anywhere. There's no inode. No folder metadata exists. It's purely a query time construction.
Which means that if you rename a folder, you're not actually renaming anything. You're rewriting the keys of every single object inside that prefix.
And if you delete a folder, the system has to issue a delete command for every single object whose key starts with that prefix. It's not atomic. If the operation gets interrupted halfway through, you've got a partially deleted folder. This is fundamentally different from a local file system where removing a directory is a single operation on an inode.
This is the thing I think most people don't appreciate. On your local computer, when you move a directory from one place to another, the files don't move. The operating system just updates a pointer. It's instantaneous. In object storage, moving a folder means copying every object to new keys and then deleting the old ones. It's a massive operation.
That's exactly the trade-off that makes object storage scale the way it does. Because there's no directory tree to traverse, there's no inode limit you can hit, there's no file system metadata bottleneck. You can store billions of objects in a single bucket, and the performance doesn't degrade the way it would on a traditional file system. The flat namespace is the whole secret sauce.
There's an interesting exception here, though. Google Cloud Storage has been experimenting with something they call hierarchical namespace.
I was reading about this. It's still in preview, and here's the key detail. You have to enable it at bucket creation, and once it's on, it's irreversible. You can't go back to flat namespace. What it gives you is actual folder resources with atomic rename operations and efficient hierarchical listing. It's designed for workloads like Hadoop and Spark, where you're doing a lot of file-oriented operations and the flat namespace overhead becomes painful.
The irreversibility is telling. It means the flat namespace isn't just a default setting, it's baked into the architecture. Adding a hierarchy on top requires a fundamental change to how the bucket works internally.
And the fact that it's still in preview, years into cloud storage maturity, tells you how hard this problem is. Most object storage users just learn to work with the flat namespace and design their key structures accordingly.
Let's talk about size. If I'm migrating data into object storage, how big can a single file be? Because the numbers have changed recently, and some of them are surprising.
This is where it gets fun. Let me go provider by provider. Amazon S3, as of December 2025, so less than 5 months ago, increased their maximum object size from 5 terabytes to 50 terabytes. That's a 10x jump, and they did it by leveraging their multi-part upload architecture.
50 terabytes in a single object. That's a lot of vacation photos.
But here's the mechanism. A single PUT upload is still capped at 5 gigabytes. Anything larger than that, you have to use multi-part upload. You split the file into parts. Each part must be between 5 megabytes and 5 gigabytes. You upload up to 10,000 parts, and then you issue a completion request that stitches them together into one object on the server side.
The 50 terabyte limit is essentially 10,000 parts times 5 gigabytes each. That's the math.
And that's S3. Now, Azure Blob Storage is actually even more generous and has been for longer. Their block blobs can reach about 190.7 terabytes. That's 50,000 blocks, each up to 4,000 megabytes, using their newer service version. Append blobs max out around 195 gigabytes, and page blobs at 8 terabytes.
190 terabytes versus 50 terabytes. That's a significant gap.
It's almost 4 times larger. And Google Cloud Storage comes in at 5 terabytes for a single object, with their resumable upload protocol recommended for large files. So you've got this interesting spread. Google at 5 terabytes, Amazon now at 50 terabytes, Azure at nearly 191 terabytes. If you're planning a migration, you need to know which provider you're targeting because these limits are hard ceilings.
The multi-part upload thing is worth dwelling on for a second, because it's not just about hitting the size limit, it's also about reliability. If you're uploading a 40 terabyte file over a connection that might drop, you don't want to restart from zero.
That's exactly the design rationale. Each part is uploaded independently. If part 700 fails, you re-upload part 700. You don't lose the other 699 parts. And you can upload parts in parallel, which dramatically improves throughput. The multi-part architecture is what makes these enormous object sizes practically usable.
We've got the what and the how big. Let's get to the part that I think is practical for a lot of listeners. Interoperability. You've got data in Google Drive. You want it in Google Cloud Storage. Or you've got an S3 bucket and you want to sync it to Azure. Daniel mentioned tools like Multisync, which he described as having huge privacy risks. And he's right to be skeptical.
This is where RC Loan comes in, and I should say upfront. RC Loan is one of those tools that, once you understand what it's doing, you realize how much heavy lifting it's handling. It was written in Go by Nick Craig Wood, first released in 2012. It's M-licensed, fully open source. And the architecture is elegant.
Walk me through it. I point RC Clone at a Google Drive folder and a Google Cloud Storage bucket. I tell it to sync. And magic happens. What's actually going on under the hood?
RC Clone uses what's called a back-end interface system. Every cloud provider, Google Drive, Google Cloud Storage, S3, Azure, Backblaze B2, you name it, implements two interfaces. One is called EFS, which stands for File System, and one is called Object. The EFS interface defines methods like list, new object, put, mcdir. The object interface provides open, update, hash, and modification time methods.
It's an abstraction layer. RC Loan doesn't care what's on the other side, as long as it speaks these interfaces.
And this is what makes it so powerful. When you run ryclone sync drive colon folder gcs colon bucket slash folder, RC Clone is translating between the Google Drive A and the Google Cloud Storage A through this common interface. It lists objects on both sides, compares them, and transfers what's different.
How does it decide what's different? Because that's the critical question for a sync tool.
RCClone has an internal equal function that compares three things: size, modification time, and optionally a checksum or hash. By default, it checks size and mod time first because those are fast and cheap to query. If those match, it assumes the files are the same and skips the transfer. If you use the checksum flag, it switches to hash comparison as the primary method, but only when both the source and destination support compatible hashes.
What hashes are we talking about?
5 is common for Google Drive and S3, one for others. The constraint is that both sides need to speak the same hash. If one side uses M5 and the other uses S256, RC Loan can't do a direct hash comparison without downloading and computing both.
Is the thing that surprised me when I was reading about this. RCClone does not implement delta encoding. Unlike rsync, which can detect which parts of a file changed and only transfer the differences, RCClone transfers objects as complete units. One-to-one mapping.
This is a huge point, and it's not a technical limitation of Go. It's a limitation of cloud provider A. Cloud storage. A's don't expose byte range patching operations. You can't say, hey, S3, bytes 500 through 600 of this object changed, here's the new data. You have to re-upload the entire object.
If I have a 50 gigabyte file and I change one byte of metadata, RCClone is re-uploading all 50 gigabytes.
This is fundamentally different from how rsync works on a local file system or over S, where it uses a rolling checksum algorithm to identify changed blocks and only sends those. RC Loan can't do that because the cloud providers don't give it the primitives to do partial object updates.
Which raises an interesting question. Is this a bug or a feature? Because there's an argument that immutable object replacement is actually simpler and safer.
I think it's both. The simplicity argument is real. You never have to worry about partial updates leaving an object in an inconsistent state. Every object is either fully written or not written at all. But the cost argument is also real, especially for large files that change frequently. If you're syncing a 50 gigabyte database dump every night and only a few megabytes actually changed, RCClone is still pushing 50 gigabytes.
Your egress bill reflects that.
Your egress bill absolutely reflects that. This is why people who use RCClone for large datasets tend to be thoughtful about their object sizes and their sync frequency.
Let me ask about something Daniel specifically mentioned, the privacy risks of tools like Multisync versus RCClone. What's the actual trust model here?
RCClone is open source, M-licensed, the entire code base is on GitHub. You can audit it, you can build it from source, you can verify that the binary you're running matches the source. But here's the nuance. When you configure RCClone for Google Drive, it runs a local web server on your machine to capture the OAuth redirect. You're authenticating through Google's OAuth flow, and RCClone stores the resulting token locally. The token never goes to RCClone servers, because RCClone doesn't have servers.
That's the key distinction. Tools like Multisync often route your authentication through their own infrastructure. They see your tokens, they potentially see your data.
With RCClone, your credentials stay on your machine. The tool is just a binary running locally, making direct A calls from your network to Google's servers or Amazon servers or wherever. There's no intermediary. Now, the caveat is that you're trusting that the binary you downloaded hasn't been tampered with. But that's a supply chain trust question that applies to every piece of software you run.
You can mitigate that by building from source if you're sufficiently paranoid.
Or by verifying checksums of the official releases. RCClone publishes S256 hashes for all their binaries.
There's another piece of the R/Sloan architecture I want to touch on, the optional interfaces. You mentioned that backends can expose capabilities like server-side copy or move. What happens when a backend doesn't support one of those?
R/Sloan falls back to downloading and re-uploading. So if you're moving an object from one bucket to another within the same S3 account, S3 supports a server-side copy operation. R/Sloan can just issue that A call and it's instantaneous, no data transfer needed. But if you're moving from Google Drive to S3, there's no server-side copy between providers, so R/Sloan downloads the object to your machine and uploads it to the destination.
Which means your local bandwidth becomes the bottleneck.
And this is where R/Sloan's multi-threaded upload support becomes valuable. When the backend allows it, R/Sloan splits transfers into parallel chunks, which can dramatically improve throughput on high-latency connections. But fundamentally, if you're moving data between providers, your machine is in the middle.
There's another feature worth mentioning, the encryption backend. R/Sloan can wrap any storage backend with encryption, so the data is encrypted before it ever leaves your machine. The cloud provider never sees the plain text.
This is implemented as a backend that wraps another backend. So you can have an encrypted Google Drive remote, an encrypted S3 remote, whatever. The encryption happens client-side using NSecretBox, which is X-SALSA 20 and Poly 1305. The file names are encrypted too, and directory structure is obfuscated. The cloud provider just sees random-looking blobs with random-looking names.
Which is a nice segue back to the folder question, because if the directory structure is just key prefixes anyway, encrypting those prefixes is straightforward. You're just scrambling the string that was already just a string.
The flat namespace makes encryption simpler in some ways. There's no directory metadata to leak, because there never was any directory metadata.
Let me try to pull this together into something practical. If someone's listening and they're thinking about migrating data into object storage or syncing between providers, what should they actually know?
I think the first thing is to understand the flat namespace and design your key structure intentionally. Don't just replicate your local folder hierarchy and assume it'll work the same way. Think about how you'll list objects, how you'll manage lifecycle policies, how you'll handle large-scale renames.
Because you won't be renaming folders, you'll be rewriting keys.
The second thing is to know your provider's object size limits. If you're on Google Cloud Storage, 5 terabytes is your ceiling per object. If you're on S3, 50 terabytes. If you're on Azure, nearly 191 terabytes. Plan your file sizes accordingly. And if you're dealing with files over 5 gigabytes, make sure your tooling supports multi-part or resumable uploads.
Third, if you're using R/Sloan, understand the lack of delta encoding. For large files that change frequently, object storage might not be the ideal sync target. You might want to think about whether those files should be chunked differently, or whether your sync strategy needs to account for the full re-upload cost.
The other R/Sloan consideration is the checksum strategy. The default size and mod time comparison is fast and usually sufficient, but if you need cryptographic certainty that your files are identical, use the checksum flag and make sure both your remotes support the same hash algorithm.
The privacy angle. If you're syncing sensitive data between cloud providers, R/Sloan gives you a local-only trust model. Your credentials, your data, your encryption keys all stay on your machine. That's fundamentally different from a service that proxies your traffic.
I think there's also a broader point here about how cloud storage has evolved. Object storage started as this back-end infrastructure thing that only developers touched. Now it's the foundation for consumer products, for business workflows, for backup strategies. And the tools that bridge these worlds, R/Sloan being the standout example, are doing a lot of translation work that most users never see.
The folder illusion is a perfect example of that translation work. Shows you folders because that's what humans expect, but underneath it's all flat keys. R/Sloan has to reconcile that illusion across providers that implement the illusion slightly differently.
It does it remarkably well, given the constraints. The fact that you can sync Google Drive to Google Cloud Storage with a single command, and R/Sloan handles the OAuth, the A translation, the checksum verification, the retry logic, the parallel transfers. That's impressive engineering.
You mentioned Google Drive OAuth. What does that setup actually look like for someone who's never done it?
R/Sloan has a built-in configuration wizard. You run R/Sloan config, you choose Google Drive from the list of remotes, It gives you a URL to open in your browser. You authenticate with Google, and then rClone captures the redirect on a local web server, usually on localhost port 53682 or something similar. The token gets saved in rSloan's configuration file. After that, all ACLs use that token. For Google Cloud Storage, you can use service account JKeys, which is better for unattended operation. No browser flow needed.
The BiSync feature for bidirectional sync?
rClone BiSync is relatively new, and it's designed for the case where files might change on both sides between syncs. It's more complex than a one-way sync because it has to detect conflicts, but the underlying mechanism is the same interface system. It's just comparing mod times and sizes in both directions and flagging conflicts when both sides changed.
I want to circle back to something about the 50 terabyte S3 limit. The fact that this only changed in December 2025. For most of cloud computing history, you couldn't put a single object larger than 5 terabytes in S3. That's kind of remarkable.
And it tells you something about how these systems were originally designed. S3 launched in 2006. For nearly 20 years, 5 terabytes was the ceiling. The architecture was built around the assumption that objects would be relatively small, and the multi-part upload system was designed to make large uploads reliable, not to enable truly enormous objects. The jump to 50 terabytes required rethinking some of those internal limits.
Azure was already at 190 TB, so Amazon was playing catch-up on maximum object size.
Though I'd argue that for the vast majority of use cases, 5 terabytes was already more than enough. The 50 terabyte limit is really for specialized workloads, scientific data, media production, genomic sequencing. Most people are never going to hit even the old limit.
Unless you're backing up raw video footage or something.
Sure, video production is one of those edge cases where file sizes get enormous. An hour of uncompressed 8K video can be multiple terabytes. For those workflows, the 50 terabyte limit is meaningful.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The average Cumulus cloud weighs about 1.1 million pounds. That's roughly the same as 100 elephants.
If someone's listening and they want to start using rSloan, what's the first practical step?
It's available in basically every package manager. Homebrew, apt, chocolatey. Then run rClone config and walk through the wizard for your first remote. The documentation is excellent and the forum is active. Start with a dry run. rClone sync with the dry run flag to see what it would do without actually transferring anything.
The dry run feature is underrated. You can see exactly which files would be copied, which would be deleted, before you commit to anything.
rSloan's output is surprisingly readable. It shows you the transfer progress, the speed, the E. It's a command line tool, but it's designed for humans.
One thing we haven't touched on is cost. When you're syncing between providers, you're paying egress fees. Google Drive to Google Cloud Storage within Google's network might be free or cheap. Google Drive to S3 means paying Google's egress and Amazon's ingress.
This is the hidden cost of multi-cloud. The data transfer fees can dwarf the storage costs if you're not careful. rClone doesn't solve that, it just makes the transfer possible. You still need to understand the pricing model of each provider.
The pricing models are deliberately complex.
Egress fees are how cloud providers make switching painful. It's not an accident that moving data out costs more than storing it.
Which makes tools like rSloan even more valuable, because at least the tool itself isn't adding another layer of cost or risk.
The tool is free, open source, and runs on your own hardware. The only costs are the cloud provider costs you'd be paying anyway.
I think the final thing I'd say is that object storage isn't going anywhere. If anything, it's becoming more fundamental. The flat namespace design, the H-axis model, the massive scalability. These are the reasons it won. File systems aren't going to disappear from our laptops, but the cloud runs on objects.
The tools that let us move between these worlds, between the hierarchical file systems we're used to and the flat object stores, the cloud actually runs on. Those tools are doing important translation work. rSloan is the best of them, and understanding how it works makes you a better user of it.
That's a good place to land. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for another day of making this happen. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.